Ryan Quinn.
Apologies here. Councillor Murnan, Councillor O'Mara, Councillor Stokes, Councillor Quinn, Councillor Riley. Anyone else? Any declarations of interest? Okay. Okay, then we're here tonight for the presentation. Sorry, folks. Guys, wee bit of manners and decorum here. Okay. So, we're here tonight for the presentation of the Northern Ireland Commissioner for Complaints and the Northern Ireland Local Government Code of Conduct for Councillors, and we're very pleased to welcome Tom Frawley, and he's the Ombudsman, if I said that rightly, and his deputy is Marie Anderson. So very welcome, and they're going to do the presentation, and then after that we will have question and answer session. Okay? Over to you, Tom.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me this evening. I'm sure a number of you have already been at and attended a previous event organised by the Chief Executive Designate at that time, I think, in relation to this Code of Conduct. And I commend him and the Council for taking the initiative maybe to go through the overall approach again on the basis that I think the more familiar we can be with these rules, the better. And I think the less prospect then people have of maybe, in a sense, breaching them. Let me begin by repeating the point I made when I was last here, that poor conduct undermines the critical trust between the public and the people they elect. This relationship of trust is essential if public confidence in local government and the democratic process itself is to be maintained. So that's the focus of this particular code. That's its purpose, is to maintain that trust and hopefully to build and sustain it over time. What I'm going to do quickly, because we will move to the question and answer fairly quickly, is just then, because we've done all this before, provide an overview again to you of the code, what I consider to be key aspects of the code, but I think I want to make clear these are just key aspects. There's a broader document that you should be familiar with. My role as an office in the code, the guidance I've issued, which is, in a sense, giving you a sense and hopefully an understanding of how I will interpret the rules when I have to make judgments about breaches of the code. And then I'm going to share with you our experience to date, that is up onto the end of September, of the number of complaints we've received and how those complaints have been managed through the system and where we sit at this date, the 25th of October. And then what those complaints to date tell us around the core issues that maybe people here would find helpful in understanding, well, where are the main breaches of the code in Northern Ireland arising? Because, again, hopefully through learning and being aware of those things, we might be able to hopefully avoid them. And then the sort of key actions that still lie ahead of us going forward, so to speak. So let me then come to the overview. Again, to remind you that this particular code is the first time that local government in Northern Ireland has had a mandatory code. Up to now, the code for local government has been a voluntary code. Northern Ireland was criticised very heavily by the Committee for Conduct in Public Office, who said that it was not acceptable that local government didn't have a mandatory code, and was the only part of the United Kingdom at that time that didn't have such a mandatory code. The leadership of government at that time, which was around 2006, said that it would introduce a mandatory code as part of the reform of local government, and that's exactly what it did. So you will know that it became effective, the code, on the 28th of May 2014, and then the more focused part of the code on the planning service became effective on the 1st of April 2015 this year. We, in turn, as an office, felt it would be helpful to, in a sense, offer a perspective from our point of view on how we would interpret the code, how we would judge it. So we issued guidance on the code on the 20th of March 2015. And then the Department of the Environment, for its part, launched guidance on Part 9 of the Code, which is the planning dimension of the Code, soon afterwards. It's interesting that in parallel with these developments, the Assembly was reviewing its Code of Conduct for members, and its new MLA Code was approved by the full Assembly meeting in plenary session on the 23rd of June 2015. And so, in my annual report as the Ombudsman, because I also undertake that work, as you know, in terms of complaints about public services, in that annual report for 2014-2015, which was published in May-June time of this year, it includes information on the performance of the Code of Conduct. Just one other thing that I think is important and has come up in the past during these discussions. The current minister, Minister Mark H. Durkin of the SDLP, who introduced this code, did give a commitment that he would review the code and its operation. Now, as yet, we haven't a date for that review, but that's a commitment he's made. And I'm not yet clear whether that will be completed during this mandate, but he has indicated that it will be. So again, you will have an opportunity, no doubt, at that time to comment both collectively as a council, no doubt individually as parties, but also individually as councillors on how you felt that code has operated up to now and the sort of amendments or changes that you might wish to see considered by the minister. So then looking at the key aspects of the code when it applies, I want to emphasize at the outset that councillors are entitled to a private life. But the reality also, once you enter public life, is that private behavior can affect your reputation and also, crucially, the reputation of your council. And that's clearly an overlap that presents many difficulties. So that many rules contained in the code apply only when you act or claim to act as a councillor. That's a reality. But there can be instances where that is not the case, where you might think I'm acting in a private capacity, but actually it overlaps into the public space and then it impacts on your reputation and thus, because you're a councillor, the council's reputation. So some rules, therefore, and this is critical, I want to focus on it for a moment, apply at all times. When the code applies, it applies to all your communications, including social media. I want to emphasize that because when we get to the statistics, you will see that many of the complaints that I'm receiving are about exchanges on Facebook, which you might consider are your business and nobody else's, but unfortunately, that is the public space. So when you're in that communication medium, including Twitter, Facebook, and indeed internet forums and blogs, then what you say and how you say it has the potential to be the basis of a complaint. And obviously that's something that I would ask you to be aware of, because certainly, as I say, the statistics to date are suggesting that a lot of our complaints are related to that area of public activity. So let's look then in some detail at the rules that apply at all times. When your behaviour might bring your position as a councillor or your council into disrepute. And that can range over many, many aspects. You can be in a public space, you can be in a public place, and in a sense, as a private citizen, but suddenly something happens or arises that the connection is made between you as a councillor and what's happened in that circumstance. But fundamentally, what I'm more interested in is when you clearly encourage, persuade, or support others to disregard or break the code, then that code applies at all times, and that brings it into major focus in terms of breaches. Clearly, when you would improperly use your position as a councillor to gain advantage for yourself, or indeed others, or on the other side of that coin, to disadvantage others, or when you improperly use or authorize others to improperly use council resources. That's a fundamental issue, and of course we all realize now that resources is a very extensive part of the infrastructure that's provided to councillors in terms of materials, in terms of technology, in terms of time, in terms of expenses and other things that are claimed. So all of that come into that whole area described as resources. There then is that whole area which can be very contentious, which is respect and freedom of expression. The code requires everyone to show respect and consideration for others. Obviously, in a democracy, political expression has additional protection under the law. But criticizing the policies and performance of other politicians, which is the stuff of politics, does not breach the code, clearly. But how that's done, obviously, is an important issue. Because politicians have taken on the role voluntarily and are free to respond to criticism, and this is a judgment that we often allude to, and this is from a High Court judgment, they are expected, you might think this is unreasonable, but they are expected to have thicker skins in responding to criticism. I'm sure that probably applies to the sensitive members of the council. But there is a robustness in politics. But there is a line beyond which robustness is not a defence either. But there is a robustness I accept, and that's the judgment that we have to make. You are entitled to ask questions equally of council officers, but there is a fundamental requirement to show respect and consideration to officers. Now, thankfully, I haven't had any complaints of that nature, but certainly in other places there have been issues about what would be perceived to be bullying and harassment of officials. And clearly that's not acceptable, just as it wouldn't be acceptable for a senior manager to bully or harass somebody. Equally, for a councillor with significant authority to do that is not acceptable either. So respect for staff who, in a sense, whose responsibility is to support and facilitate the council's business is also hugely important. The other key aspect of all of this, of course, which provides the baseline against which many of the judgments have to be made, is the register and declaration of interests. Hugely important piece of the infrastructure of all of this. And it's something that isn't completed just because you've made one registration. It's something that's dynamic and ongoing. So as things move around, as your interest changes, as your work maybe position changes, all of that needs to be constantly reviewed. So you must register your personal interests, employment, business, property, and memberships of organizations, all of which might impinge on your work as a councillor. You must declare any direct or indirect pecuniary financial interests and withdraw from meetings if those exist. That means leaving the room. And I think that's the ultimate protection for yourself in that circumstance. I wasn't there when that decision was taken, and I can only give you that advice. Some people feel they can be in the room and I didn't influence the debate in any way. That may well be so, but that introduces a level of judgment then to others in terms of how far that presence in the room impacted on the decision. But then equally, you must declare any significant non-pecuniary membership interests. In other words, those are non-financial interests, and you should withdraw. But in some instances, it is, again, I think, reasonable to stay in the room during those discussions. But again, that's a judgment. But I think sometimes to err on the side of caution is a sensible principle. And just finally, to underpin all that, the test is not whether your decision would be influenced by your interest, and this is quite a challenging and subtle point, but whether a reasonable and impartial member of the public who knew all the relevant facts would think it likely to influence your decision, back to being in the room at a certain moment in time when you have a financial interest. It's the perception of these things which I know sometimes can feel unreasonable to people. As I've said at the outset, there then are political, there are particular problems around planning and the planning function, which have always posed major challenges for elected councillors. I think most people consider it to be vitally important that local elected representatives have a significant influence over planning. And that's why I think, on balance, most people welcome these new arrangements. But however, they bring with them particular challenges for those who have to make, quite often, very, very difficult and controversial decisions. And that's why I think Part 9 becomes particularly important for you to be familiar with and aware of. You do know that the Department of the Environment has provided separate guidance on how the code applies to planning matters. Your conduct, therefore, in planning will be determined by the role you play in planning decisions. And as you know, that varies from one planning decision to another sometimes. If you are a member of a planning committee, you must, keep an open mind until you have all the facts before you. I suppose the comparison I would make would be to an interview. You know, you shouldn't be bringing into an interview views and perspectives on individual candidates. The purpose is to be as fair as you can by looking at the candidate that presents on the day. Equally, proposals when they're being considered, if it's possible, and I know sometimes this is very challenging, to keep an open mind until all the facts have been presented to you. And therefore, when that happens, I think it's much more easy to facilitate a circumstance where your decisions are based on sound planning considerations. And of course, if you decide to move to a position that's contrary to the planning officer's recommendation, or to, for example, your council's development plan, it is essential that you explain your reasons for taking that decision. So it is an informed decision in that sense, and the record shows why you've chosen to take a different view. Just quickly then, to look at my office. My role is to investigate and to adjudicate on all complaints. We're very clearly of the view that all complaints should be made in writing to our office. We, in principle, don't look at anonymous complaints, but if there were exceptional circumstances and we had to make exercise of discretion, we could do, but that would, in our view, be very exceptional. We have created a dedicated directorate inside the office that specializes now in the investigations of complaints about standards in local government. And they do all our assessment of a complaint and the investigation of a complaint. And then separately, completely separately, I have no involvement in the investigation. I will then do an adjudication on those cases that are referred to me by the investigating directorate, so that there is a separation of the two core activities. So, I just want to finish, if I may, with some key messages. As a councillor, it's your personal responsibility to ensure that you are familiar and understand your obligations under the code. So again, to ask questions and clarify and seek guidance is very important. To take advantage of any training that you are offered. And if you require advice about the code or how it applies to you, to contact the chief executive or someone else of the senior standing within the council, such as the senior planning officer on planning matters, and get their guidance. And they will refer you either by giving you the answer you seek or where you might get the answer. Let me quickly then go to the statistics. This was the caseload in our office from June 2014 to September 2015. Now remember, planning only applied from April 2015. So we had 6 inquiries which didn't lead to a complaint. We have received 29 written complaints. We have closed 11 of those at assessment stage, which basically are saying, no, there is not a basis for a complaint in this instance. The number closed at the assessment stage, which we then move on to a more detailed analysis of the complaint, is 10. And the number determined at investigation stage is 3. The number of complaints ongoing as I speak is 5. So then our experience. There is the spread of the complaints across all of the new councils. And you see the numbers. Some have no complaints as of to date, and others have obviously some complaints. Not huge numbers, but still a number. And you see your own council there. I'm making no commentary on that. But, you know, that's obviously not something that people in this room necessarily have control over. But you can see that this council sits at 5 compared to others, so it has the highest number at this point. But that changes daily, so that could be changed literally in a week's time. To quickly then move to the experience to date, we thought it would be helpful for you to have an insight into the basis that informed the complaints. We have captured the first section under obligations as a councillor. This include requirement to act lawfully and not to bring the position of a councillor or the council into disrepute. Of the complaints we've received to date, 15 have had that basis. Behaviour toward other people. This is around that whole theme of respect and consideration for others. 15. Use of position or abuse of position. This includes a requirement not to use the position of a councillor to secure an advantage for oneself or to disadvantage others. 4. Disclosure of information. This is the whole area of confidentiality. 3. And decision making. This includes the requirement to reach decisions objectively on the basis of the merits of the circumstances involved. And of course, that's a fairly subjective form of complaint. And we have had 3 of those. So that refer to more than one breach. So obviously, in some of the complaints, there are a number of breaches recorded. So the total number is 40. If we then look at, finally, the final slide, complainants, we have had 50% of the complaints from other councillors and 50 from members of the public. The majority of the complaints, as I've already said, relate to respect and or disrepute, many as a result of Facebook postings. Therefore, I would commend you in operating your Facebook account to consider good practice and your council's social media policy, if it has one. I'm not sure whether you do have one, but it is important, I think, and helpful to develop one. And then when you are posting on Facebook, to make a clear distinction between the political and the personal. If it is personal, check your privacy settings and limit access if necessary. Otherwise, it's public. If you allow others, e.g. party workers or family members, to update your social media accounts, how do you ensure the code is complied with? Our assessment of such complaints, just to reassure you, looks to balance the need to show respect and obviously that other key right of democracy, freedom of expression. So that's a balance issue that we're trying to constantly achieve. The final slide before I close is this, what lies ahead of us. And basically, clearly as I've said, Minister Durkin has indicated a commitment to review the code. Clearly we would want to contribute to that and I suppose have the raw material that may be helpful in doing it. We also have just completed what we're calling alternative action procedures because we don't think we need the whole panoply of the code for what we would call minor breaches. So we're going to put forward proposals that will deal with minor breaches in a much more efficient and, I suppose, proportionate way rather than having the whole force of the investigation when the issue is a minor one. Just as the Minister is doing, we're looking at our guidance, and again we'll be inviting your commentary on that, on how helpful our guidance is, what would you like to see clarified, developed, or indeed amended in the guidance. But I think importantly, for the first time now, we will be able to include our own case examples. So it will not just be cases from the Republic or Scotland or Wales. It will also include cases from Northern Ireland. Again, an important document each year will be our annual report, which will continue to have a separate section on the Code of Conduct on complaints. And we do want to continue with these types of occasions. I've indicated previously that I would be happy and my staff would be happy to come out to party meetings if they would be easier in terms of the sort of open exchange of ideas that you might prefer. But we want to try and keep you as engaged with us as we can to ensure that people are as aware and as familiar as they can be. Just a couple of adjustments just to finish. We are in the process of completing a major modernization of the Ombudsman's Office through a new piece of legislation, which is at final consideration stage in the Assembly. It will alter the title of this office, my Office of Ombudsman, to the Northern Ireland Public Service Ombudsman. But what that legislation will also allow us to do is to separate out the local government standards into the Commissioner for Local Government Standards, which we think will focus the work and make clear that while we have carried the title Commissioner for Complaints, it will now become the Commissioner for Local Government Standards, and we think that will be helpful. And we also therefore have our authorities, both in the adjudication process and beyond, sharpened, if you like, and made more explicit so we can do our work more efficiently. But when that is passed, we will certainly advise you of those changes. I'm happy to take your questions. Could I also say that I am absolutely dependent on my deputy to take the difficult questions. Marie Anderson has worked with me throughout the development of all of these procedures, and her contribution is significant and hugely important. So either she or I will answer any questions you have. Thank you very much.
Tom, thank you very much for that. We'll open the floor now to questions. Councillor Walker.
Thank you very much, Chair. And Mr. Frawley, thank you very much for your presentation. This is the fourth time I've heard it. I've heard it a number of other occasions, but I have a couple of points here I would like to raise, and I think they're very, very pertinent to this council. First of all, has the Ombudsman any teeth to deal with councillors effectively who abuse their position within a council? Now, some people's not going to like this. We have an elected representative here who, over the last number of weeks, has been convicted of serious crimes.
Councillor Walker, can I just advise you to be careful about what you say?
Yes, yes, I know. And
I'm just asking you, and to be careful.
Yes, Chair, this is a fact. He has been, I'm saying, we have had a councillor who has been convicted of a crime. So he has. That's what I'm going on. Nobody hasn't been convicted of a crime. And as far as I'm concerned as elected representative, he's bringing the council into disrepute. So he is. The other question I would like to ask, and I have been told, if a councillor is suspended, say, for a year, for whatever reason, I'm led to believe that he's still entitled to his basic allowance. I would like to know again, is that the case of a councillor suspended, irrespective of what for, should it be 6 months, a year, is he still entitled to his
$14,200? Okay. Yep. Councillor Walker, thank you for your question. I detect in your voice some frustration. I would merely say this, that what we have to do in these circumstances are let the courts take their course. And that's the first thing. Everyone's entitled to fair treatment under the court system. You know, these can go on for a period of time, which many lay people think are way too long, but that's the way the process works. And clearly what people on occasions do is they appeal decisions and so on, all of which prolongs the process. What I can say to you, and I don't want to talk about specific cases and what outcomes might result, because I think, again, a fair hearing demands that things aren't prejudged. But the circumstance that we would see is that once that court hearing is complete, we will receive a report or a complaint, which we will then judge as we would any other. And then if it warrants an adjudication, it will be adjudicated on. To give you the assurance that in the event that someone is suspended or is excluded, as can also happen, then they will cease to be eligible for any allowances. And that can apply for a period of time up to the whole term of an existing council. So, you know, this all needs to take its course, and I'm sorry and can understand entirely your frustration, but I think what we want to do at this point is to behave in a way that's completely consistent with the spirit of the legislation and with the law, and to arrive at a conclusion that is made absolutely fairly and properly and will not be the subject of further challenge, but will actually stand up and be robust in whatever area or aspect it's scrutinised.
Okay, Councillor Walker. Yeah. Councillor Kern.
Thank you, Mr. Frawley, for your presentation. I've already heard it before, but you know what I mean. Just when you were making your presentation there, you did say that the Minister has set up a three-man review team in relation... You're shaking your head. Why did you not?
No, Chairman, I didn't say a three-man review team.
Oh, sorry, I misled you there, but
sorry.
I'm led to believe there is a three-man review team set up there. Rephrase that so I will. Ending up there. it's good to see that a review has been taken of the Code of Conduct, is there a time factor here? Because, you know, we are going to have an election in May of next year, and I would like to think that that might be, review may be taken, completed before that election takes place.
Well, again, just to clarify, the fact that I was unaware it was a three-man review suggests that the Minister hasn't yet advised me that he has embarked on a formal review. What I do understand from him, and in my recent conversation with him, was that he intended to have a review. The mechanics of that review he did not share with me, nor did he give me a date for the commencement of that review. So I'm assuming that he will advise when he has all those arrangements in place, because certainly in the meeting I had with him, he gave every indication he would expect me to contribute to that review. I certainly take the spirit of your comment that there is a time issue here at play. I mean, clearly, as you suggest, I think, in your question, the current mandate of this Assembly will expire probably in March time. So certainly there is a certain time pressure if a review is going to be completed, and then any proposals would have to be submitted to the Assembly for decision. So that becomes very tight in terms of this mandate. Now, that's not to stop Minister Durkin completing a review and then leaving it in the in-tray of an incoming minister. He may well return himself to deal with under the next mandate. But you're quite right, there is a time pressure on this that needs to be addressed. I accept that entirely.
Chairman, just maybe to pick up on that there, just in terms of the partnership panel last Wednesday, the Minister mentioned that he had established a review team under the chairmanship of a former chief executive, but he didn't give any more details of that there in terms of his time scale and the rest of the membership on the team. So that's all the information we'd have at this point in time, Chairman.
Councillor Enright.
Thank you. Good presentation. Thank you very much. It can be sometimes difficult to assess whether or not there is grounds for a complaint. And I'll give you a hypothetical situation. If a council were to call for the destruction of property, council property, because, say, for instance, a minority language was represented on the sign, in my view, that would be good grounds for a complaint. But if someone was to, in the papers, suggest that, or perhaps predict that a council sign would be destroyed because it contained a minority language, and that sign was subsequently destroyed. It's difficult to know whether the prediction could be treated by way of a complaint in the same way as somebody calling for the destruction of a sign, given the fact we're talking about the public media and the press. Is there any way in which it's possible to contact your office to try and tease out those sort of situations to see if calling for or predicting the destruction of a particular sign would qualify as a complaint?
I'll ask Marie to answer that. She's better as a psychic than I am.
First of all, our office is there to investigate complaints and adjudicate. So if in that role, we have to remain independent and impartial. And the giving of advice, I would say, is not our role. However, in relation to the specifics, what I can say is we've never received a complaint of that nature. But what I would say is that when we are assessing our complaints, what I can tell you about is, first of all, the complainant must refer us to a breach of the code. So there must actually be a breach of a rule, such as the rule against bringing your counsel into disrepute, the rule about respect for others. So the complainant must specify a rule, and the complainant must bring some evidence to show that a rule has actually been breached. And I think that the point about your suggestion that actually something might happen or predict, there actually must be a breach of a rule and there must be evidence of that. Having said all that, and back to the Ombudsman's point about our alternative action paper and our alternative action, we apply a test of public interest. So we are applying public interest factors. So even if facts are proven, is it in the public interest and is it proportionate to investigate a complaint? Is it proportionate for us to use our resources? And I would say that something that is hypothetical is probably not something that would be proportionate, that would be a proper use of our resources. On the alternative actions, if someone had inadvertently, unintentionally, or perhaps carelessly technically breached a rule of the code, then we can look at action short of an investigation. And what we are suggesting there, take the respect principle. Say there was a heated exchange in the council chamber between a chief executive, an official and a councillor. It may well be something that we would not investigate because it didn't breach the respect rule, but it may be something that we suggest to the parties that actually there should be some informal apology or some shaking of the hands and getting on with it. So for hypotheticals, I'd suggest that the specific facts aside, we cannot investigate hypotheticals. What we can investigate are those complaints that are evidence-based and that refer to a breach of a specific rule.
Okay, thank you. Councillor Carr?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Tom, for the presentation. I, too, believe that we should be revisiting this every so often just to remind ourselves what it's all about. Given the statistics that you produced where there were 29 written complaints and at the initial assessment stage, can we investigate 11 were turned away, 10 at the next stage, and the number determined at the investigation stage was 3. I suppose the first question in relation to that was, did they attract any sort of a penalty for the 3, or what was the outcome of those 3, really?
I can tell you that in relation to the 3, that there has been no breach of the code found.
Oh, right, okay.
So actually, I think that's quite reassuring. I think it's reassuring for the councillors here.
So it was only determined that there was no sanctions of any description?
There was no breach of the code found. There was no evidence of a breach of the code. Back to the point that when we assess and look at these cases, we're always looking for evidence that the code has actually been breached. And in those cases, that there was no breach of the code and no sanction has been imposed.
And
the Ombudsman has not adjudicated to date on any complaint.
Yeah, I think that is reassuring. I suppose it maybe asks the question, do we need this complete setup around the Ombudsman if none of these sort of things, because it's a full department almost, you know.
Pardon?
It's a
full department.
Right.
It's a full department.
Could I
just suggest something to you? This is early days. These are early days and the numbers are small. So I don't think that you could detect a trend. And what I would say is something that I think is important is that the number of cases that are coming through shows the strength of the assessment process, and that we do not, and there were concerns previously, the Ombudsman's aware of this and others are around this council chamber room are aware, there was concerns that we would investigate or that we might receive vexatious complaints, but we it's a robust process and we will not investigate vexatious complaints. In terms of the size of the department, the size of the local government team is very small. It's a director, two senior investigating officers and myself. So it's not a huge department. And I think the Ombudsman can speak to the issue of the resources that were involved in the initial planning of this. It was actually a much more expensive, I think.
I think it's fair to say,
regime.
Without wanting to in any way sort of comment on what went before, in the original proposals that were put forward in terms of standards in local government, each council would have had a standards official. Then the department that I would have had would have been much larger. In fact, it was independently costed at £900,000 per annum for the infrastructure to support it. It's now being delivered at roughly £250,000. Now, you know, I certainly accept your point that that should be kept under review as well. It shouldn't be any different to anything else. If it emerges, I think probably over a period of a mandate, so I would say over a period of 5 years, that is unnecessary or that we can do with less, then I think we should do with less. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I am completely focused on the fact that money that is spent on what many people might describe as bureaucracy is money not available for services. So I would always be in favour of whatever resources we have applying to service delivery as distinct to oversight. On the other side of it, one of the big issues debated in local government was that if you're going to have the sort of standards in local government that give people confidence, that move us away from some of the historical problems we've had in local government about trust and confidence, then you need a robust oversight arrangement. Now, that's the balance that's constantly being sought here and the one that we would seek with you to achieve.
Okay. Thank you. And it is reassuring. I'm not making a complaint against the Ombudsman, but it is reassuring.
Okay. Charlie?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Mine was sort of way answered in your alternative action procedures. Now, I mean, the code of conduct itself is fairly comprehensive and it covers all angles. And minor breaches, what is determined as a minor breach, have sort of answered that. But my point is, have you got the arbitrary power just to introduce that particular alternative action procedures for minor breaches, or does that have to go for all party agreement at the Assembly?
No, actually, the legislation provided that the Commissioner for Complaints, which is the title in this particular role, that the Commissioner for Complaints could take any action alternative to or in addition to an investigation. It was something that particularly the Committee for the Environment was keen that the Ombudsman would have, or the Commissioner for Complaints would have, the full range of
powers available, so that if there was a minor breach, that could be dealt with without a full investigation
and adjudication. It seems very comprehensive now if all of these new action procedures for minor breaches.
Chairman, without wishing to prolong this part of the debate, I think the idea for it's maybe an alternative to what the councillor is focusing on. Our view is that there may well be breaches where they don't warrant the detailed examination of investigators and directors and so on. that there is the potential for a settlement or an outcome, as Marie suggested a moment ago, for a conversation or a shake of hands to put a matter to a close, so that let's not move into something very formal. I think everyone in this room will recognize that once you move into formal investigation, then the whole nature of the problem, in a sense, escalates. So, you know, to look at ways of solving things informally and quietly without the huge application of resources. So it's actually to try and simplify the process rather than to create more complexity. And let me say also in a spirit that we should review this as well, because if what it does is create more complexity, then we should walk away from it. It isn't achieving what we intended it to achieve.
Chair, could I just add that I'm happy to share the alternative action paper if you'd like to circulate it after this meeting. One of the areas for alternative action is actually training on the code of conduct, so that if a councillor, as I said, inadvertently failed to register an interest or declare an interest, and it was something that was really to do with lack of knowledge of the code of conduct, then one of the areas that we can recommend is to attend training. So it really is about making the whole of the ethical regime work.
Okay, folks, everybody happy enough? Oh, sorry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks, Tom, for the presentation. The code of conduct for the general public, how much do they know about the code of conduct? Because they're a massive group of people. I'd say 90% to 99% of people don't know a thing about the code of conduct, don't even know it exists. I mean, have you taken any steps to try to inform the public about it? And secondly, I'm intrigued by the comment that you made about that councillors should have thicker skins than other people. Could you give me your reasoning behind that?
Well, no, I'm not. I would want to say I should say that. I didn't say that. A High Court judge said it. So, I mean, I'm not claiming. I merely, his view was that in the robust exchanges that go on in the political environment, that, you know, people say things and they to and fro with arguments and commentary, that, you know, some might say run off their, I don't think it necessarily runs off their backs, but I think that in a sense that that's the robustness of the environment. So I'm not in a way saying that's something that I would seek that you should do. I mean, I am an absolute believer in civility. I think good manners and civility make for much better atmosphere and ultimately make for much better decisions. Because I think when that sort of banter keeps in, or that edge to a conversation or a discussion develops, which is the nature of politics, I accept entirely, then maybe some of the opportunity for the more complete answer gets lost. So I'm not in any way advocating. I'm just saying that he stated as a fact that by choosing to put yourself forward for election, you move into a different environment, and that there will be, quote, robust exchanges that require people to have thicker skins.
If I could just deal with the public information point, I think it's a very important point. In the run-up to the launch of the code, we actually met with the DOE communications group, and it was one of the areas that I was quite surprised to find that they hadn't actually addressed was, are you going to tell the public about it? I say I was surprised because, as Liam Hannaway knows, for 17 years I worked in the housing executive, and I remember when we started to undertake work in relation to housing benefits, there was a huge media campaign to inform the public and in order that they could know about their right to take up the housing benefit. So there hasn't been such a media campaign. It's not for the Ombudsman's Office to actually, if you like, not tout for business, but spread the word. But nevertheless, we do feel responsible. And I just today signed off an information leaflet that I hope the Ombudsman will approve and will be issued on our website and in leaflet form, possibly through council offices later in this month.
Okay, thanks. See, the press are here tonight, and maybe we may not want them to be here tonight to be able to advertise the complaints procedure against us. So thank you very much, Mr. Frawley and Ms. Anderson. Really appreciate you being here. I take it that's no more questions. Everybody happy enough?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, we'll move on then to item number 4. And it's the presentation by the Chief Executive on Organisational Design. This item is deemed to be exempt under paragraph 4 of part 1 of Schedule 6 of the Local Government Act, Northern Ireland 2014. Information relating to any consultation or negotiations or contemplated consultation or negotiations in connection with any labour relations matter arising between the council or government department and employees of or office holders under the council. The public may, by resolution, be excluded during this item of business. And can I ask the young person in the back to go on out too, please? You can just sit in the breakout area. It's the bad mommy I am.
Okay.
You
want to set something for you?
Okay. Propose and second that? Propose by I got the press aren't here, Stevie, but I'm sure you'll get it in there somewhere. And seconded by Stevie Burns.
In principle, the recommended structure, subject to consultation and amendments as agreed at the meeting, authorises to complete and implement the design for the remaining tiers and the procurement of external technical assistance and engagement of additional HR resource to assist with the implementation.
So, has everybody agreed in principle? With proviso of consultations.
Yeah. Proposer and seconder, Chairman.
Proposer and seconder? No, they come out of committee.
Okay.
They propose and second to come out of committee. So, Glenn
and Gard. Gard. Okay.
Gard. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, folks.
We can give him that.